Welcome, it's Podcast Pearl Droid. I'm not too sure what episode it's going to be. Depends when I get around in which order to edit these. But it's 90-something. But it's the usual format. I'm Russell, and he is Leon. How are you, sir?
Not too bad. Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, good. Bearing up. Nothing more than a bad dose of cabin fever in shade hard.
What you want to do, Russ, is you want to listen to the Toshak years from Podcast Pearl Droid, because it's a six-hour epic, isn't it? Something like that. That'll eat up some time.
Wait for the director's cut. I enjoyed talking about that and doing that a lot more than editing it, particularly that last one, which was an absolute monstrous pain in the ass. But it's out there, and I think we've done a good job, and I guess to a certain extent we're biased, but actually I think there's some really, really interesting nuance. And I know we said perhaps during the second one, maybe, or was it the start of the third one? I can't remember. We said that actually, if people are setting their views on him in whichever camp, and he is, as Gaz said, in that a very polarizing figure, then most people who are equally sort of polarized, if you like, in their views and quite set in their opinion on him, aren't probably going to change that fundamentally. But I do honestly think that we've probably invited some people to maybe reconsider. I'm not saying they're necessarily going to change it, but actually there's some reason to go, oh, okay, that's an interesting perspective. So, yeah, I'm quite proud of what we've done there.
Yeah, I think it's a good listen. I listened to the final part earlier this afternoon. I think we've done it justice, so I hope so anyway, as in terms of exploring both angles, really, because it's not a black and white thing. I just don't think anyone could really say, okay, we didn't qualify, therefore we failed, or the Toshak era was great. Not even Toshak's biggest fan, not even Tosh fan, could argue it was just 100% joy and smiles kind of watching some of those games. It required their sort of, an in-depth look at exactly, kind of what that era entailed from a few different angles, and I think we've done that.
And I did hold back a particular clip that I found on YouTube for the very, very final bit of that final part, which I thought summed him up really, really well, actually. But I won't give any spoilers away. In contrast to the forensic level of attention and detail that those had, there's a bit more levity here. And this was your idea to do, actually. So do you want to present it and explain what this is about?
Yeah, well, seeing as this week we were supposed to be playing in Euro 2020, and we're not, obviously, I just thought it might be fun to have a little look back at our previous games against our group opponents, Switzerland, Turkey and Italy, to kind of maybe fill in a bit of a gap, because people have kind of got I've seen tweets starting about, the kind of the weather in Baku at the moment and stuff like that. So maybe sort of help out with that feeling of what should be happening right now. We'll have a look back at some of our previous games against these opponents.
We're going to run through these in the order that we would be playing them, which as far as I know is the same order. It'll be next year as well. I think all that's happened is just been rolled forward 12 months. So we would be starting the tournament against Switzerland. I've gone on to the excellent EU-football.info site.
I'm on 11vs11.com, which I'm staying loyal to, because I like this a lot, and it was pretty useful doing research for the Flynn book as well.
These are good sites, they're good resources. I was a big fan of Gary Pritchard's Gori Chware, Kid Chware site, but it doesn't seem to be around anymore, which is a shame. Not only are we sort of starting this with Switzerland, who we've played in for the first time in 1949, but that was the final game of a three-match end-of-season European tour, which was the first tour that Wales ever undertook of official, internationals, full internationals. We went to Canada in 1928 or 9, but didn't play any full internationals. just played a series of kind of games against sort of clubs and provinces around Canada. So we went to Portugal, Belgium, and Switzerland for a couple of weeks, which sounds lovely, actually, in May. Rocked up in Bern at the wonderfully... Your German pronunciation is probably better than mine.
No. You say it.
At the wonderful Wankdorf Stadium in Bern. We got beat 4-0. They'd have probably enjoyed themselves on that tour, I guess.
So I've got Red Dragons Filsted's history of Welsh football here, which is an essential resource for so many of these podcasts. But a foreign tour is a step into the unknown. PW guys were keen to secure their place on the plane. Travelling party was made up of 15 players and 10 officials, including team attendant C. Layfield, the FAW secretary, 3 council members, the doctor, 3 officers, and a press liaison officer. A lot of confusion, kind of even, you know, a short trip over to the continent was seen as kind of very complicated in those days in terms of paying import duty on official gifts to the Belgian FA, etc. Also, the sort of continental interpretation of rules was a bit of a struggle. Shirt tugging, body checking, other fouls just went on and on in that game against Portugal, which we lost 3-2, I think. And then we went after a pretty tough match. There were a few injuries, and then we went on to Belgium and lost in Liège. And then, yeah, humiliated 4-0 at Burns Wankdorf Stadium. in a match delayed where Welsh officials complained that the match ball was undersized and underinflated. The Welsh party was lucky to have escaped injury when a team coach was involved in a road accident on their return from a pre-match tour of the Swiss Alps, with 8 of Wales' 15 players injured by the time they came to face Switzerland. The FAW had an early warning that continental tours could not be undertaken with a small squad. So his only appearance for Wales was Jack Roberts, 31-year-old fullback, was picked for that tour as partly as cover for the goalkeeper, William Hughes, because he would go in goal if Bolton's goalkeeper was injured, because in those days there were no substitutions. So yeah, just sounds like a bit of a chaotic tour, but I guess we're just kind of finding our way in those days when it came to playing outside of Wales, outside of the United Kingdom, really, because we barely did it before that. Quite noticeable how stark the difference between home and away results was during this kind of era, because then, you know, having lost 4-0 in 1949, 2 years later, we played Switzerland for the first time at home and we beat them 3-2. So I don't think there probably wasn't much difference between the quality of the sides. It's just when you go out to these exotic places, which seems kind of strange now, the world seems a lot smaller, to think of someone like Burns being exotic and a trip into the unknown. But it kind of was in those days. Even though they were friendlies, it was often the case that you would have a kind of reciprocal agreement almost that you'd play at home and away against a sort of foreign team in that era. So two years later, we played Switzerland at home. We weren't playing them again for several decades, and we beat them that time.
I think what's interesting is that for each of those teams we played on that tour, we then hosted them at home, and we won each of the return games. So I think it goes to show quite how... I mean, in Belgium, we pumped them 5-1. I think it's quite telling, you know, that home and away... you know, the travel and the impact of all of that probably took on the players. Here's the thing about Jackie Roberts. He's one of the 5 Welsh internationals who were all raised on the same street in Swansea called Alice Street.
Oh, yeah, I referred to this street on the podcast before, didn't I?
Yeah. So it's Alice Street. It's a part of Swansea called Cwm Dŷ. And you've got the Charles brothers. You've got Roberts. You've got Mel Nurse. And you've got another international in the late 40s, a peer of Jackie Roberts, a guy called Ernie Jones. All 5 raised on Alice Street, which I think is just a terrific
little
nugget of information, a bit of a curio.
So just to talk about the stadium again.
it would be rude both not to and to talk about it.
It's great. It's actually sort of wank and wanker sort of quite sort of common here. There's a mechanic a few streets from here called the Gunter Wanker, and I guess you'd pronounce it Wanker. The sign above his garage, just this big blue sign says Wanker across it, and I you know, first time I passed it, I laughed very loudly at this, as you would. But I was told by my wife that I was not to take a photo and not to post it on social media because it wasn't funny, apparently. But yeah, Wankdorf. Yeah, so, sounds appropriate because it doesn't sound like the best performance from us in that game.
No, no.
Anyway, yeah, we played a race course 2 years later, 1951, main 51, and we'd be in 3-2. Trevor Ford scores twice. Ron Burgess got the other one. Trevor Ford, two. So that's two of his 23 Wales goals there, which was an extraordinary record considering he only played 38 times for Wales.
John Charles' second cap in that game.
That's a hell of a strike force, isn't it? Like John Charles and Trevor Ford.
Yeah.
And overall Church as the sort of forward three, if you want to.
Yeah.
Identity.
No, there's some legendary names in that. Alf Sherwood, Roy Paul, Burgess, Ford, Old Church. I mean, there's, you know, a couple of other less upside profile players. Noel Kinsey, Mal Griffiths, Glyn Williams made his debut. So these are people you, or Glyndŵr Williams, to give him his proper name. These are players I suppose you'd find yourself reaching for reference books to find a little bit more about them. But yeah, there's some stardust there, but Old Church only his fourth cap, so it's still 7 years to go before the World Cup, and these players they haven't yet established themselves as these top league players, let alone international players.
Yeah, it's interesting to reference the World Cup there, because I think that the game where we beat Hungary, which was a sort of almost like the second round match, even though it was almost a playoff for the quarterfinal, was actually the first time that we'd won a game on the continent. I'm pretty sure. I might be wrong there. The qualifiers in those days, sort of post-war, were international. So weren't often sort of in the late 40s and 50s, we weren't drawn to kind of play against continental opposition. So it's extraordinary to think, but it was 1958 before we won a match outside of the United Kingdom and Ireland, I think.
Well, I mean, another factor in that, of course, is that the home nations were forever in dispute with FIFA and UEFA about different things. You know, amateur status. We then saw our backsides over the fact that the Irish Free State was acknowledged as a FIFA member in 1925, 26. First game was 26. I think they were accepted in 25. So actually, when you look at Ireland's early games, the fixtures, we refused to play them. Because we sided with the FA, with the Scottish FA, and obviously we had loyalties to the IFA, Irish Football Association, based in Belfast. And I tweeted a couple of links to the blogs that provide a bit of a potted history of why there were two associations. And of course, I think we've all probably at some time thought, well, why is there only one Ireland rugby team, but there's two Irish football teams? And it goes into some detail about that. Italy were the first country to accept the invitation and the offer to play the Irish Free State, as it was called. They then again reciprocated and played them at home as well. The first game was in Italy, but Ireland then played Belgium, they played Spain, they played Netherlands, they played Hungary, so they had no choice but to go and play these countries. We was a bit more protectionist about it, I suppose. We did play France in 1931, I think, was our first trip.
33, I think it was, our first ever, yeah.
Yeah, 33, yeah.
I don't know if you heard it, but Ellis James went on the Blizzard cast to talk about his favourite game or something like that. They do a feature, and he's there with Jonathan Wilson talking about the quarterfinal win over Belgium. And he kind of, you know, refers to all the past failures to qualify. And there's something about Ellis claiming that we were the smallest country to ever reach a tournament semi-final. And Jonathan Wilson pulls him up and says, well, what about Uruguay in the 30s? And there's a bit of a discussion about that. And Ellis said something like, if we had been allowed to compete in World Cups in the 30s, we might have actually done quite well. It's ironic considering, you know, we had this huge weight to kind of playing a tournament and all that. But, you know, if we win, I think we won the home international championship three times in the 30s. So you think, like, 1934, 1938, if we went to those World Cups, which we didn't because it was sort of British football was just so parochial at the time. You know, we might win the World Cup in 1934. We had a good team. Sort of history of Welsh sport could be completely different. You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting, yeah, it's another one of those sort of sliding doors moments. So yeah, it's then years and years and years, I can't do the maths, almost 50 before we play Switzerland again. And it's in the Bobby Gould era, which we've now gone public and said we're going to have to do it. So we're really going to have to do it.
24th of April, 96, yeah. And it's called an own goal. I have no memory of watching this match whatsoever. But Coleman scored an own goal after 31 minutes, and then there's a penalty after 41 minutes. So for a comfortable 2-0 victory. And I guess Switzerland were warming up for the match against England at Euro 96. I suppose we should be flattered in a way that they thought playing us would be preparation for facing England, that Danny Coyne would be like playing David Seaman, and Gareth Taylor was obviously like very similar to Alan Shearer as a player. Starting lineup. Matt Bowen was captain. I never knew he was captain. Barry Horn played, bizarrely. I don't know what was going on there. Okay, I thought Barry Horn was a regular captain at that point. Vinnie Jones and Barry Horn very subtle ball playing. Andy Legg, Kit Simons, Chris Coleman. No Giggs, obviously. Arts and Gareth Taylor up front. So obviously, I guess we'd have been trying to pump it up to win some headers. But Switzerland were a decent team at that time. They deservedly drew against England at that tournament. There's, looking at the lineup, Stefan Chapuisat is a good player. Ramon Vega, Stefan Henshaw. I don't think we were any match for them, but I have no memory of this game whatsoever.
I don't have much. What I remember, though, is that we played San Marino, didn't we, about a month or two later in a qualifier, which sort of started in the June for some reason. And I don't really remember why that is. They would start so soon after Euro 96 had finished and not in the season. But anyway, maybe that was Bobby's doing in terms of arranging the fixtures. So it wasn't what perhaps looks on paper as this end of season friendly for us. It's a bit of a trot out against a team that's obviously facing British opposition in the tournament upcoming. We still had another game to prepare for, so I can see why he was throwing in some new caps as well. So Simon Davis, not that one, the other one, won his only cap. Christian Edwards got his only couple of minutes of international football. Andy Marriott made his international debut. Was at Wrexham at the time. It's one of those keepers that. We've had a few of these, haven't we? People like Lewis Price, Jason Brown, take a move and then just seem to settle for just the bench. It's frustrating because I thought Andy Barrett was a cracking keeper.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of seeing something similar with Danny Ward at the moment, aren't we?
Another one.
Frustrating. Mid-20s now, isn't he? You just think he's got talent, surely. I mean, he did so well that loan spell at Huddersfield, and then his career's just gone nowhere since going to... Well, returning to Liverpool and then being sold to Leicester, and it's just, well, you just got to play, It's just professional football. You've got to play some football. And it's kind of frustrating, really, because you can see this guy's a real talent, yeah.
So we have been a qualifier a couple of seasons later.
Yeah, this was off the back of actually two wins, wasn't it? Because we'd beaten Belarus and Denmark away. The Denmark win was a fluky one because we were poor. We had one shot on goal, or one header on goal from Bellamy, which was the winner, and still managed to score twice because the keeper let one through his legs for the equaliser. We were terrible, really, but somehow managed to win that game. Much better against Belarus and probably deserved to win that. But then, so we were quite well placed at the time going into that game away against Switzerland. So it was in a sense, a bit of a crunch game. I think we were thinking, if we win this one, then we've got a really good chance of qualifying. But it was just the fact that Denmark win was such a fluke was really exposed by this game, exposed by how poor we were. We conceded a sloppy goal, as we so often did during this era, really early. Chapuisat scored. I remember Kit Simons just sort of missing missing a ball and sort of getting twisted. Oh, it was just like some Keystone Cops defending that was so prevalent with us at the time. I remember Andy Johnson hitting the post with a header, though, which might have made a difference. Just not long after they scored, we nearly equalised. That's the only sort of chance I can remember as having. And it was a weird thing with the goalkeepers because Paul Jones started, but came off after 26 minutes and Mark Crosley came on. I don't know, it just all seems a bit chaotic, doesn't it? If you take your keeper off after 25 minutes, the sort of countdown to Bobby Gould sort of quitting had started really with that game.
Yeah. By the time he played the return qualifier, he'd gone.
Yeah.
So was this one of the Mark Hughes-Neville Southall joints, or was Mark Hughes on his own by this point? I think he was on his own, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Because we had a doubleheader, which was Italy away. We lost, Gould quit. Then it was home to Denmark, which was Neville Southall and Mark Hughes. And then we had the doubleheader to finish it, which was away to Belarus, which we won. And then home to Switzerland. And it was just Mark Hughes in charge then. Neville Southall wasn't in the picture. It was at the racecourse and sort of Sparky's home ground. It was a dead rubber. We were out of it. Switzerland couldn't qualify because it was pretty set in stone that Italy and Denmark would finish first and second in the group. And so it was very low-key. There was only 5,000 there. Poor game, poor crowd, really poor Wales performance. The highlight of which was Neil Roberts coming on for his debut, Wrexham player, and it sort of that was sort of woke the crowd up when he came on 77 minutes at least. It was just a bit of a nothing game, really.
Matt Jones came on for his debut as well. One of my abiding memories is I think the tickets were about 20, 25 quid as well. And I was long finished university and I was just basically broke, wasn't working, and just went, I can't justify that. And I was in Wrexham that night actually. I was there listened to it on the wireless, I think. I don't think I watched the game. I can't quite remember. But, I mean, even for then, that sounds ridiculous. I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, doesn't it? That amount for the way the ticketing pricing is gone.
No, it was 20 years on. I think it was like 25 quid or something. I remember going with my dad. But I had to sort of persuade him to go with me because he was just like, what? You know. At that price. And obviously it put a lot of people off because there's only 5,000 there. It was just a real, you know, it was a shame in that respect because it was Mark Hughes returning to his home ground, his sort of home game as manager. You know, home ground, I mean, he never played for Wrexham, but, you know, he made his international debut there and scored against England. There's no gigs. John Oster played. He was really poor. There's guys are sitting in front of me who was just shouting abuse at Oster the whole time. And it was one of those where I just thought, God, he sort of deserves it. I mean, I don't like it when the crowd sort of gets on the back of players. I never think it really helps. But in this case, I sort of thought he had a point. It was just so sort of half-assed. And it was sort of like, let's just get the 90s done and let's start again. because it had been a sort of pressing decade for Welsh football, really. I mean, for international football. And it started with so much promise, and we'd had those two near misses, and then it just all fallen to pieces, and we really needed to reset and go again. And thankfully, to some extent, we did.
Yeah, yeah. That's the only time Robbie Savage ever played for Wales at the racecourse in his 39 caps. Interesting little nugget for you. And it was also Mark Delaney's debut, a player who I was hugely, hugely fond of. Well, we did touch on him briefly, didn't we, in the Toshack years, in that so far as he was really beginning to struggle with injuries by the time Toshack came in. Did win caps under him, but not many, and eventually retired. And if you think about how late he came into the professional game when Cardiff signed it, albeit he'd been on Manchester United's books as a kid, but his professional career must have lasted, what, about, I'm not looking at this, six, no, seven or eight seasons, which is nothing.
Yeah. Oh, shame.
Quality fullback.
Really good play. I totally agree. He was actually good that game. I remember that as well. And thinking, okay, yeah, good. We've got a good young fullback at last. Because he'd just gone to Villa and started playing in the Premier League. And we hadn't had a Premier League fullback play for a few years, if I remember.
No.
Sounds sort of bizarre, doesn't it? But we hadn't had a fullback actually play in the Premier League for a few years before Delaney.
And yes, and he was a Villa player by that point. He was never capped as a Cardiff player. So then we don't play them then for a few years, and then we get them in the qualifying campaign for Euro 2012, which we sort of ended the last podcast on, or the start of that campaign we ended the last podcast on with the Toshak years.
Yeah, it sort of follows on, doesn't it, really, this game now?
Yeah. Because it's one of the ones that Brian Flynn is the caretaker coach for.
I was at this game, and funnily enough, I was at the last three games we played against Switzerland. I think it's more than I've seen us play against any other opposition three times, actually. And I talked about this one, and I just said to him, look, you know, it was never a 4-1, was it? And he just said, no, it was the penalty that was the killer in the 82nd minute. Just seeing it here. But I went with my friend Andy, who's also from Wrexham and lives here in Innsbruck, and Mark, who's English, he's a Forest fan. His unbiased opinion was just 4-1 was just a ridiculous result, considering it's a very even game. You know, 2-2 would have been fair. But we were just low on confidence at the time. You know, we'd not won many qualifiers. We'd just, you know, we'd lost against Montenegro and Bulgaria, so we'd lost the first two. And it was a very young team. You know, Bellamy didn't play, Gavardon didn't play, Simon Davis didn't play. You know, even though these were our most experienced sort of Premier League players at the time. So he was casting around a bit. You know, Darcy Blake played, and Andrew Cross, Andy King, Dave Edwards, Simon Church up front. Ribeiro came on for his debut, Sean McDonald for his debut. You know, a lot of players there who only won a handful of caps. Talking about, you know, Blake, McDonald, Ribeiro. It was interesting in that Bale equalised not long after they scored the opener, and pretty good promise going forward. Bale had sort of come good for Spurs as an attacking player by that time, and he was, you know, our main attacking threat. Obviously, it's got a good goal. You know, just a few minutes later, they go up again 2-1, and so we're playing catch up again. And we just didn't look solid at the back. We didn't look like we could keep them out. So it's 2-1 going into half time, and then second half was just really evenly contested until they get a penalty, which was probably not a penalty in the 82nd minute. Inla puts it away, and then they score again in the last minute, and so you end up with a thrashing and a 4. I can remember the next day, because we'd stayed in Basel overnight, looking at the papers, and in the Swiss press were like, yeah, 4-1 sort of headlines, all this kind of woohoo with, you know, Swiss hammer Wales and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, it just wasn't like that. But a loss is a loss. And Bryn Law sent me a really good email when I was writing the book, and he said, because he interviewed Brian after the game for Sky Sports, and he just said, you know, just crestfallen, because he knew with that result that the chances of him ever becoming full-time Wales manager had gone. He was right.
We all felt that, didn't we? All being truthful.
It was a trial. It was that those two matches were a trial, which I think was unfair, but that's kind of how it was at that point. If you know, if we won them both, Flynn would have been given the job. There's little doubt about that. But you know, we lost, and the FAW kind of had their justification then for ditching him.
What I like about Bale's goal is that it's technically an assist from Andrew Crofts, and he goes in to absolutely munch one of their players. The ball's there to be won. But, you know, he was going to be taking everybody with it.
Yeah.
And it just breaks free. It's a cracking pass. But there's no way it's even a pass, let alone an intended pass.
Yeah, I think it was on Inler, their captain, who was like kind of their star man as well. So that he made it even better.
No, he was definitely going into...
Yeah. It was good. I got ridiculously drunk that night. We ended up in a bar, and Barry Hall was there. And so me and Andy went over. Andy's an Everton fan as well as being a Wrexham fan. And for some reason, he was wearing his ski gloves when we went over to meet him. So Barry Horn commented on Andy wearing gloves inside this hot bar. And then he was like, yeah, well, it's cold. Anyway, a bit later on, we're all chanting, "Barry, give us a wave, Barry, Barry, give us a wave." And he started chanting back, "Andy, show us your gloves, Andy, Andy, show us your gloves." It was a bit of who needs Cantona, we've got Barry Horn. Yeah, it's good night. Yeah, I have to admit, I did puke up the kebab that I attempted to eat about 2 o'clock that morning, or 3 o'clock.
And I can't imagine a kebab in Basel is all that cheap either.
No, nothing's cheap in Basel. Nothing's cheap in Switzerland. No, no. Went for a round and it was like 28 francs or something. Crazy.
How would you have gotten from Innsbruck to Basel then? Is that a train journey?
A three-hour drive.
3 hour drive, okay.
Easy enough, yeah. I was working mornings at the time. I think I was finishing at like 10 in the morning, working early mornings. And Andy came to pick me up and we just drove straight on to Basel. Yeah.
That's how Aaron Ramsey and Chris Gunter do it, don't they, from London, or back when they used to, on the M4, pick up and read in, mixtape. speaking of Gunter, of course, he didn't play in that game because he'd had a red card, didn't he?
Of course.
One of his few games. I mean, until Giggs came along, it was one of those, like, I think it was like 6 games or 7 games that he'd missed in, you know, forever, basically. But he'd had a red card, didn't he? Was it late on in that Bulgaria game?
I think it was a 1-1, wasn't it? Because we were pushing forward for an equaliser, and yeah, it was definitely red. Yeah, they sort of took one for the team. Yeah.
But then we play them in the return, by which point Gary Speed is now manager, and probably at that point, I mean, I remember we talked about it on the Toshek years around, for example, that friendly win against Norway, playing some smaller countries, but in a qualifier, that was about as convincing a result and performance as we put in for many a year.
No, we were brilliant. I took the train. I was staying in Cardiff, but I took the train, so that was sensible, rather than the car. A few memories of this one. One would be sort of being on the train with quite a lot of Wales fans, from Cardiff going to the game, and some people on the train kind of looking confused at some of the chants and stuff, like, what is going on? And I just felt that a bit kind of strange, but like, that's kind of where we were at that time, that people within Wales didn't know that we had football games going on, you know, a qualifier as well, wasn't friendly, you know. Got to the station in Swansea and I was taking cash out at the station. This guy in a sort of tracksuit, looked kind of sporty, was looking at all these people going past and sort of some people chanting and stuff. And he comes up to me and goes, "Oh, what's the occasion?" And I was like, "Oh, we're playing Switzerland in Liberty." And he looked really confused, like, you know, Wales play football? Just barely, you know, that's kind of where we were sort of at that time. And it took a few years before we were sort of in the public consciousness a bit more. But we were, you know, it was results like this which sort of brought us back into that public consciousness, because we were great, fully deserved the win. And it was a good Swiss team. I felt that it was sort of a bit underplayed at the time, because Switzerland were 20 in the world. I'm looking at the lineup now and they've got Bernaglio in goal, who was Wolfsburg's keeper at the time. He just won the Bundesliga. Lichtstein, I'm pretty sure, was at Juventus.
Yeah.
Barami, where was he at the time? Before West Ham, perhaps, but very good player. And you're looking at there across the midfield with Inler at Napoli, Xhaka, obviously at Arsenal now, but Xhaka, Shaqiri, and Frey, all Basel players who'd lots of Champions League experience. And Dürdjok, the striker, was, I think, at Bayer Leverkusen, one of the top teams in Germany. So that's a really strong Swiss team, if you look through it. We were better. I think we deserved the result. A young team, obviously, for us, as they were at this time. And Joe Allen's full debut, he was superb. He was absolutely first start, I'm pretty sure. He was just wonderful. Ramsey scored the penalty. He was kind of not perhaps quite as good as Allen in that game. Bayor was electric, really, and scored the second goal. And it was fantastic to see us beat a really renowned team for the first time in a long time. And I really enjoyed that night.
It had clicked, didn't it, now under Speed. So we'd performed really, really well at Wembley in the previous game, although we lost. Earnshaw missed that absolute sitter. We then won this one. We then won in Bulgaria. And then we you know, Norway were lucky to get away with just four in the friendly. It's those three victories, but you know, four games that it really clicked, and it looked so promising. What I always think back to this era, though, as well as it obviously being under Speed, is we played, and I've just double checked this, we played nine games that calendar year. Andrew Crofts played in seven of them, started six, and you begin to realise quite, you know, he was basically a first choice pick for Speed, which I don't think is necessarily remembered or appreciated by fans. And you know, it's a lot of the players that were there in 2016. We talked about in the Toshak years. You know, I referred to them when I went on the Directors of Football podcast when they reviewed "Don't Take Me Home." Is you know, and I, you know, I made the point that that's not about the Euros. I mean, it is. It's about, for me, it's a film about you know, a group of close young men overcoming a tragedy, and the medium through which that happens, I suppose, is football, and there's that. Redemption, as it were, then, in terms of the Euros. And who knows, there may be other things as well. But all through that era, all those players are there. But somebody that didn't quite last as long is Crofts. Although he randomly had that substitute appearance, didn't he, just before the Euros, which was an odd one.
Very bizarre. He sort of gets a weird call-up still. Oh, how many caps he got altogether? He must be over 20.
129.
That's not bad, is it? It's really... During this period, he was good. So he was sort of, you know, really sort of combative. Didn't have the technical ability of those around him, obviously. But Speed obviously liked him in there to try and sort of disrupt and upset. And he sort of was effective for a while because he played in those notable victories that we had under Speed. Just to go back to Joe Allen, because he was that good. Walking back from the Liberty, I was just behind this sort of slightly older couple. And the guy was sort of mansplaining to his wife kind of what happened in the game. And he was saying, oh, well, you know, we wouldn't have got away with some of those mistakes in midfield if we'd been up against better opposition. I was on a high and I was like so buzzing, delighted with that game that I interrupted and sort of said, like, we were brilliant. And just said to him, look, what about Joey Allen in the midfield there? That was absolutely brilliant. And he was like, yeah, he did all right. You know, it seemed like people were kind of slow to sort of trust in this team. You know, it took a while, didn't it, before the crowds came back and people sort of really started to believe. It was like, well, yeah, okay, we did all right, but against a better team, we'd be punished for this, that or the other. That was the game where I sort of thought, Joe Allen really belonged at the international level on the big stage, because he was the kind of player that could keep the ball and would kind of make good decisions and possess intelligence that you need to be successful in international football.
Yes, that's Switzerland. And I think if we were about to face them, and you know, all being well, no pandemics and the rest of it, would you fancy our chances against them?
Yeah. Yeah, they're always there, sort of there or thereabouts, aren't they? They've qualified for a lot of tournaments, often get past the group stage, and then sort of rarely get to the quarterfinal. It's sort of, they seem to like, it's the kind of team that get knocked out in the second round a lot. A decent team, but never like a real top table team. I think we should be confident of beating them. Yeah, it wouldn't be easy. I mean, if you look at our historical record, is lost 5, 1-2, non-drawn. So, you know, they're historically better than us. But looking at the two sets of players at the moment, we should be confident of beating them, yeah. La, 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 la.